a symmetric spaces, and so there's this unified description of all of them, which is due to the embedding in n plus one dimensional space. And so any maximally symmetric space can locally be described by these two equations. So first, you have sort of like a Euclidean geometry, but for k plus minus 1 or 0, you modify this thing like that. And then you have a constraint, which defines your hypersurface in that geometry. And so if you solve the constraint and plug it back to your equation over here, this is the n-dimensional metric which you get from there. And as I say, it's the locally complete description of any maximally symmetric space. Of course, you can have some global problems, various identifications and stuff like that. So you can have, you know, the actual story may be a little bit more difficult, but locally the metric looks like this in these coordinates. What I also told you is that these spaces are called maximally symmetric because they admit maximal possible number of Killing vectors. And I showed you yesterday that maximal possible number of Killing vectors in any spacetime is simply given by n times n plus 1 over 2, which sort of corresponds to initial data for Killing vector equation. And they consist of a vector and an antisymmetric matrix L. So now we know that in flat space or Euclidean space, this really is the case. I'm not going to show it explicitly for ADS or DS or whatever spaces, all these Killing vectors, and you can find the construction somewhere else, for example, in Weinberg. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to convince you, yes, there is indeed that number of Killing vectors for all these spaces. And so the proof is very, very simple. So it's enough to show that this constraint actually is invariant under basically Lorentz transformations. And you know that you have precisely that number of Lorentz transformations in n plus 1 dimensions. So the proof goes like that. So you take this constraint, and you observe that it's a constraint. Is invariant under the change of coordinates, where you take new x tilde a to be, let's call it lambda ab xb, where this lambda is almost like a Lorentz transformation, but it is Lorentz transformation with respect to this eta abpq metric. So where eta AB PQ K is eta CD, and again PQ K, and then lambda CA, lambda DB. So this is precisely the, if we had just the flat metric here, it would be just a condition for Lorentz transformation. However, now we have this little bit more complicated metric eta PQK. And so if this is a little bit more complicated metric, then this will not be the standard orthogonal group, but it will be a little bit more complicated group. So group matrices lambda AB form representation of, and now the group is O, P, and then there is this thing here, and then Q plus 1 minus K over 2. So for all this discussion is valid only for K plus minus 1, because K equal to 0 is sort of trivial if we know that it's that's the standard case. So here I'm not getting 1 half or whatever. It's only for K plus minus 1. Okay. And so you can, similarly to what you do with the Lorentz transformation, you can consider transformations which are close to 1, so and then infinitesimally related to 1. So decomposing lambda AB as delta AB plus something small. And then putting all the indices down, lambda AB, eta AC, PQ, and K, and then lambda CB. So this is how I put the indices down using the metric eta. And so plugging this ansatz into the defining equation of these transformations, so plugging it over here, you will find out that these lambdas, small lambdas, are antisymmetric exactly as in the Lorentz group case. So this is minus lambda BA. So now, basically, how many are these? So of course, for each lambda, which is like, you know, these are the parameters characterizing my transformation, and each index here lives in n plus one dimensional space, but these are antisymmetric. So there is n plus one over two generators for this. Okay. So in other words, I have n times n plus one over two Killing vectors for this group of transformation. Okay, which gives n times n plus 1 over 2 Killing vectors. So I haven't constructed them explicitly, but I showed you that indeed all these spaces do have the maximal number of Killing vectors by this group. Question? Okay. So now we know everything there is to know about maximally symmetric spaces. I mentioned to you that there are some interesting spaces in between them. So for example, the ADS space, the DS space, which is more interesting for cosmology, of course, the Minkowski space, and so on. But also, if you are considering the Euclidean geometries, it is just the standard Euclidean space, or it is the sphere, or it is the hyperboloid. And it turns out that these three are actually building blocks of our universe. Building blocks or in other words, they actually appear in the Freeman-Robertson-Walker space-time, which I'm going to discuss now. So that's why we went through all these maximally symmetric spaces, because we will use these for further discussion. But of course, this is a chapter on its own, and it's quite interesting, and it will be useful for other courses as well. Okay, questions? No? So part B, FRW spacetime. So Friedman, Robertson, Walker, sometimes there's another guy, Lemaitre, somebody like that. Okay, based on. So now the observation tells you that our universe is isotropic in every direction. But what do you mean is the spatial direction, of course. So it says nothing about time. So we are looking at a given time, and you are observing the isotropy. So now, assuming that this is true for every observer in the universe, you have also homogeneity, again, on every spatial slice. So that means that our universe is maximally symmetric isotropic and homogeneous on a spatial slice but of course this observation is true only at a given instance of time. So now in general this there may be some time dependence of all this And so at a given time, at a different time, you will have, again, isotropy and homogeneity, but the whole thing may be blown up or maybe. But spatial geometry can, and now put arbitrarily, of course, this is not true, because it has to do, according to the Einstein equations, stretch or shrink in time. And so this dependence on time is described by one function, which is denoted usually by A of t, and it's called scale factor. Okay. And the metric now, the full four-dimensional metric, is the three-dimensional part, which is homogeneous and isotropic, plus the time thing. So you have ds square is minus dt square plus a square t. Now I need Euclidean geometry, so I'll have gij 30k dxi dxj. So this is my maximally symmetric space. Now I can blow it, I can stretch it, or I can shrink it in time, and I have also time coordinate. Of course, the principle could be some other function of time, but I can absorb it into t. Yeah?
Did autonomize
That's what I mean by that, yes. So I fix time, and I have some, yeah. Yeah.
Is there a good argument why the k should not change over time?
Well, according to classical general relativity, it cannot. You cannot sort of change, discretely from one. You cannot change topology. You cannot change discretely from one space to another. Of course, in quantum gravity, you could.
The k was multiplied by some rho squared, right?
Yeah.
So we could cross through k equals zero smooth.
Yeah, maybe, but I would say generally not. Yeah, because what this tells you is basically, it's not a smooth metric, right? As you are changing k, it's a discrete property of the metric. It's a discrete parameter in the metric. It sort of describes the topology of the solution, and the topology of the solution cannot change according to Einstein's theory. It can in quantum gravity, but it cannot in classical general relativity. Yeah. And so this is the metric, and of course now I can use explicitly what we have constructed over here. So I can write it as at square, and then now my eta ab is just delta ij, and then plus k xi xj rho square minus k x square. And this is what is called FRW spacetime. And so it depends only on one function A and three discrete one parameter, discrete parameter k. Okay, so two remarks. So one of the remarks is that, and we will always, almost always do so, you can set rho equal to 1 by appropriately rescaling the coordinates. So this is, for example, achieved by saying that my new, the old xi is rho times xi tilde and a tilde over rho or something like that. So you can rescale the coordinates and set rho equal to 1. And then, of course, if rho had dimensions of length, then the new coordinates are dimensionless. And so all the dimension, or these xi coordinates would be dimensionless, and you know, the length would be hiding in this A. Or you can do anything else. But anyway, so I'll set rho equal to 1. Okay. So now terminology, I said you have three possibilities, k equal to 0 plus minus 1. So if k is equal to 0, that means our geometry, our spatial geometry, is just Euclidean space. And you call this flat universe. Because the spatial part is really, really flat. If k is equal to plus 1, then you have sphere. And you say that it's a closed universe. And finally, if k is equal to minus 1, then you have the hyperboloid here, and it's open. And you will study this a little bit in your tutorial why this terminology.
Do we have any kind of evidence of which k is the one that...
Yeah, so it's the simplest one, probably. It's the flat one. But you cannot exclude, you know... based on general discussion, you cannot exclude this k plus minus 1. But it seems that we are very, very close to k equal to 0. So the simplest possible thing, actually, is probably happening. But of course, it's a question why it is so, right? So why exactly k equal to 0 is preferred. We will discuss this a little bit later. Yeah. OK. So now, if you look at this geometry, again, you may be asking about the symmetry of this geometry. And it's obviously that now the FRW spacetime is not maximally symmetric, because actually there is, for example, no time-like Killing vector. There is this general dependence on time hiding in A. But more generally, there are no boosts, right? So you have only three spatial translations. And three rotations, precisely the homogeneity and isotropy in the spatial slice. So we have only 6 Killing vectors, not 10, as would be needed for maximally symmetric space. So there is no boost invariance, if you want. And so that means that you have preferred observers in the spacetime, as I talked about it yesterday. So if you start moving with respect to the surrounding fluid, then actually you don't see homogeneity and anisotropy. So there X is that preferred frame. And so this is associated with the commoving observer, or freely falling observer, if you want. And so the commoving observer in these coordinates, so t would be his proper time. And the commoving observer is, of course, sitting in that universe at fixed xi. So xi, I equals to constant. The commoving observers do not change their position in these coordinates xi. So you have to fix xi and only, you know, let the time run. And this is the coordinates of the commoving observer.
Are they geodesic?
Good question. They should be. Why not? Are they? Interesting question. Okay, your homework. They should be, right? Well, we shall see. We will discuss geodesics. So, okay. So now you see that there is this arbitrary function a of t. And so as long as you don't impose the Einstein equations, is a of t can be in principle anything. So the scale factor can do various things. Of course, not all of these will be allowed by Einstein equations. But the Einstein equations, well, the solution of the Einstein equations depends on the matter content of the universe. So we will first have to specify what the matter content of the universe is, and then we can solve for this AT. Okay. So at this point, let me just introduce two parameters which actually characterize how this A behaves in time. And so one of them is A dot over A, where by dot I mean dA over dt. And this is called Hubble's parameter, or Hubble's expansion rate. And sometimes another parameter is used. So this basically characterizes the first derivative of A with respect to time. But sometimes you need to characterize also the second derivative. So now you have A double dot and then A square. And this is called deceleration parameter. That basically tells you, you know, so we know from observations that the universe is expanding, so A is getting bigger and bigger. But the question is this expansion actually accelerating or is it accelerating? Is it getting more, is it expanding faster and faster or slower and slower? And so this is basically described by this deceleration parameter. Okay, so now very, very boring part. We have to introduce some other coordinate systems, although this coordinate system is quite useful. And these coordinates x, I, and t are very often used. But there are other coordinate systems which are used in cosmology and sometimes useful. So let me discuss those. So other coordinate systems. So one of them is spherical coordinates. So basically, on your spatial slice, you introduce spherical coordinates according to the standard prescription, although the x1, x2, and x3 are not necessarily Cartesian coordinates because we have this k term there. But anyway, so you pretend that they are Cartesian coordinates, and then you use just the standard prescription, sine theta cosine phi. And then x2 is r cosine sine theta sine phi. And x3 is r cosine theta. So you pretend that these x's are Cartesian coordinates, and you would just do the normal transformation to spherical coordinates. And if you do that, the metric actually looks quite simple. And so the metric looks like ds square is minus dt square plus a square. And then you have dr square 1 minus kr square, and then plus r square d omega squared, where d omega squared is just on the sphere, d theta square plus sine square theta d phi square. Okay, so this is another form of FRW spacetime. Using the spherical coordinates. However, there is perhaps even more useful another set of coordinates where you introduce a new radial coordinate. So new radial coordinate. And so this is defined so that you get rid of this ugly denominator here. And so you say that r is, and now it's some function which depends on k. And so the new radial coordinate is coordinate chi. And you define it to be sine chi or sine h chi. depending on what k is. Okay, so this is your new coordinate chi. And if you do that, then the first term simplifies, and your metric looks almost beautiful, dt squared plus a squared. And now the first term, so for example, if I have sine, right, so I'll have cosine here, and I'll have k is plus 1, so this is 1 minus sine, so it's cosine again. So this simplifies drastically, and you just get e chi squared. Okay? And so this will be true for any k. So you have d chi squared. However, the other term, this r, is really what this function s is. Right? So you are postponing the problem to the other part, basically. So s k squared of chi d omega squared. But you know, this part is nice. And because people are usually interested in behavior of radial motion, which is typically what people study, you want to really simplify the radial part of your metric. And so this done by this chi. Okay. So now let me just look at which of these coordinates, whether the coordinate chi or whether the coordinate r, is actually more natural from a three-dimensional perspective. And so a beautiful picture can be drawn in the case where k equals to plus 1. So let me just take it as an example. I cannot draw k equal to minus 1 because it has hyperboloid in it, and it's very difficult to draw. So anyway, so if we have k equal to plus 1, we know that our spatial slice is just S3. Okay, so let's think about this S3 as embedded in the four-dimensional auxiliary space. Okay, so this is our sphere. So this is my coordinate x4, and then this will be the other coordinates, and then this is my S3. So this will be, let's say, x1, x2. I'm suppressing x3. Okay. So now, if you look at how coordinate r is introduced, it's just the magnitude of x1 squared plus x2 squared plus x3 squared. In other words, if I take a slice like this here, then this will be my coordinate r. It's the magnitude of x1 squared, x2 squared, x3 squared, which is suppressed. So it's this thing here, or that thing here. It's the radius of that cup. Okay. On the other hand, I set rho equal to 1. So rho was the radius of the sphere in that four-dimensional space. So the radius here, rho, is equal to 1. And if you look at how r and chi are related, you see that r is sine chi. Okay, so r is sine chi. So chi is actually this angle here. Okay. But of course, because I have a sphere of radius 1, then the length of this thing is precisely chi as well. Okay, so this is also chi. So typically, you want to place your observer at r equal to 0 at the origin of your coordinates. So this is chi equal to 0 and r equal to 0, and that's where your observer is typically. So now you see that the relation r is sine chi actually has, you know, very nice interpretation. So r basically measures, so let's say I have a star here or a galaxy which I am observing from this point here. So there's a star here. So now you see that what about coordinate r measures is basically like a distance hover in this embedding space, right? So r is actually natural from embedding perspective, embedding, because I have to think about this as really, you know, embedding the whole thing into the four-dimensional space. So R measures the radius in the four dimensions, whereas chi sort of lives on that sphere, right? So chi actually measures the 3D perspective. 3D perspective. Because it's really, you know, I live on the surface of that sphere, and what chi measures is the distance on that sphere, on that surface. So chi coordinate here is really, really nice coordinate, and it describes, you know, what's happening from the 3D perspective of your observer. And, you know, if you want to, you can try to do the same analysis for hyperboloid. okay. Questions? It's all very easy, right? So now, let me talk about something which is interesting, and it's called Hubble's flow. And you can do it in for general k, but let me, for simplicity, do k equal to 0. So linear metric is very, very simple. You have just minus dt square, and then you have a square, and then dxi, dxj. So now, yes?
One thing that's confusing about this picture is I thought that the k saying, like in the spherical case, was referring only to the geometry of the spatial dimensions. So,
okay.
Like, why do we draw it like a sphere in the time dimension as well? Like,
No. Thank you for that question. So this x4 is not time dimension. This x4 is the embedding x4. So there's no time here whatsoever.
Okay.
So this is you're looking at the spatial geometry of your FRW spacetime from this embedding perspective on your maximally symmetric spacetime.
Okay.
So you know that you have three sphere on the spatial slice, but you are looking at this three sphere from four dimensional perspective.
Okay.
So x4 is really a spatial dimension.
Okay.
Yeah. Thanks for that question. Okay, so now you can talk about this. So this is gone. And when you are talking about physical things, you're talking about orthonormal frames. So only orthonormal frames are connected with what an observer can actually observe. Right? So if I want to introduce an orthonormal frame there, of course that will be, well, dt squared, that's my one frame, but then I would have a squared dxi dxj, well, dx squared. And so I can diagonalize that by saying, well, I have a new frame, xi physical, if you want, which is a times xi. Okay. And so this thing will really measure the distances in that orthonormal frame. So this is a physical distance. Physical distance. Whereas these xi measure coordinate distance. So this xip measures a physical distance. For example, I have an observer sitting at zero. This is my observer here. And then I'm looking at the star here, which has the coordinate xi. And so now I'm questioning, you know, how do I see that star? How that star is moving with respect to my observer here? Okay. And so about the physical distance to that star is a times xi, not xi. Okay, so now what is the velocity? So physical velocity, you just differentiate this with respect to some time parameter. Let's just use t here. Okay, so vip is just dxi physical over dt. And of course, this has two parts because I have two terms. So I will first differentiate A, so we'll have A dot, and then xi, and plus A times xi dot. Okay. So now this thing here, you can work on it, so you can divide it by A and multiply it by A. So if you divide it by A, you have A dot over A, which is h. So you have h And then you return a, so it's a times xi, which is the physical distance, xi p. And then plus a xi dot. So you see that the physical velocity is split into two parts. So one of these parts is called peculiar velocity. And it's this one here. So this is called vi peculiar. And so what it describes is, you know, how fast is the star moving due to its changing coordinates xi. So, you know, if that star decides, I don't want to sit, you know, at xi equal to constant, but I want to change xi, so the velocity due to that change of coordinates is precisely captured by that part here. Okay, and so it's peculiar velocity. So it's basically a velocity. Velocity with respect to commoving observers. So if you have commoving observer which is sitting at that xi equal to constant, then this is precisely the velocity which is with respect to that. On the other hand, this thing here has nothing to do with changing xi. So it's purely the velocity which is due to the expansion of the universe. And that's called Hubble's flow. So this thing is the velocity Hubble's flow, which is a velocity due to the expansion of the universe. Okay, so really, you know, the physical velocity can be split into these two things, into, you know, what's happening if you sit on that xi equal to constant and only, you know, you observe these things receding or coming to you because of the expansion of the universe. And then there's this other piece, which is if I start changing my coordinates of that object. Okay, question?
The Hubble's expansion rate, is it a constant or it's allowed to vary with time?
You mean this h?
Yeah.
In principle, of course, it depends on t. So, yeah.
But sometimes you hear things like Hubble's constant.
Well, so when people say Hubble's constant, they mean the value of h at the moment. Yeah, and so, yeah. But yeah, of course, this can change. Because a, you know, in principle, a can have any dependence depending on the matter, which is you know, in our universe. And so, yeah, it can do anything. OK. So, you know, all these things are very, very simple. But in some sense, they are also amazing, right? So that's really just a simple expansion of the universe, and it causes these various effects. So now let us look how the particles move in our FRW spacetime. And by particles, of course, I mean also galaxies and other big objects like stars. Okay, so now motion of particles. In FRW. So let me use a special parametrization where I absorb m into my velocity. So I'll say that my four momentum of a test particle is just p mu, which is dx mu over d lambda, where lambda is some affine parameter, which is related to a proper time by this thing. So I'm absorbing m, the mass of the particle, into So m is the mass of the particle, and tau is the proper time, and lambda is the affine parameter which I'll be using. So now the momentum square is, of course, in the metric which is hiding, well, in the FRW spacetime using these xi coordinates. So it's just minus p0 square plus a square gij 30 k pi vj. And of course, it's a constant. It's equal to minus m square. And people call this big capital P square, where P is the magnitude of spatial momentum square, of course. Okay. So you just, you know, they introduce a shortcut basically for this thing here. Okay, so that's our parametrization of the motion. So now, of course, you want to solve the geodesic equation. So geodesic equation, which is nothing else than p mu nabla mu acting on p nu equals to 0, which can be derived. And so I don't know if you did that in the relativity course, but nobody is really trying to write down the geodesic equations, because you have to calculate the Christoffel symbols and stuff like that in order to write that equation. So you have p mu nabla mu p mu equals to 0. So people don't usually do that, but they start from Lagrangian. And it's the simplest possible Lagrangian, which is a function of p square. So or equivalently, you know, in the end, it's the same thing, of course. But it's much, you know, for me, it's at least much easier to remember Euler Lagrange equation than how to calculate the Christoffel symbols. So you have L 1 half g mu x mu prime, where prime is just d over d lambda. So that's my affine parameter here. So what you see here is just basically the velocity square, right? And it turns out that any Lagrangian which is a function of velocity square will give you the geodesic equation. So you can take any function, crazy function, some power, square root, or whatever, and you get the right geodesic equation. Of course, the simplest one is without square roots, which Neil didn't tell you, so you had square roots. But this is simpler. It's no square root, so you can just differentiate it. Okay, so this is your Lagrangian. And then you just write down the Euler Lagrange equations for this Lagrangian here. So in our space-time, explicitly, it's still the FRW space-time in this simple coordinate system of xi. There's 1 half minus p prime square, and then plus a square gij 30 k xi prime xj prime. So that's your Lagrangian. And all you have to do is write down the Euler Lagrange equations for this. OK. In particular, what is actually enough for us is to discuss just the first component, the time component of this Euler Lagrange equation. OK, so the t component. So we have dl over dt. Well, the only thing which depends on t is, of course, this a. Okay, so we have twice, but there's one half here. So we have a dot, and then gij, let me not write those things. And then this is by our definition of p is just pi pj. Okay, so now again, it's useful to write it in terms of the Hubble parameter. So you divide by A, multiply by A. So you have H A square Pij Pi Pj. And if you look at our definition of the magnitude of the spatial momentum, it's precisely H P square. So this is H P square by the definition of the magnitude of the spatial momentum. So that's left-hand side of the equation. And of course, this must be equal to dl over dt prime prime as the second part of your Euler-Lagrange equation. But dl over dt prime is just this term here. So it's minus t prime and prime. So about p prime is just p0. So this is minus p0 prime. OK? And so that's the only equation which we will need. OK? Very good. So that's the Euler-Lagrange equation. Now we have to play a little bit with the constraint that p square is actually minus m square. So let's differentiate that equation. So differentiate p square equals to minus m square. So what you are getting is, of course, if I differentiate m square, I get 0. And that's equal to, now it's minus 2p0 p0 prime, and then plus 2 times p p prime. Okay, so that's another equation which we have, just differentiating the mass constraint for the equation. Okay, so now the trick is to look at a quantity which is minus p and p dot. Okay, so no reason for that, at this quantity, but let's look at this quantity. So it's minus p p dot. So now p dot is dp over dt. So now I can do it as dp over d lambda over dt. But d lambda over dt is related to p0. So now it's no surprise that this is minus pp prime over p0.
Sorry, it's kind of like that we have p for the whole momentum and also p for this space.
Yes, sorry. So one is supposed to be capital, the other one is supposed to be small. So this is small. You write it like that. And these are capital ones.
Okay.
Yeah, sorry for that. This is just my stupid handwriting. Okay, so now we have pp prime over p0, but for pp prime, I can use this equation to write it in terms of p0. So using that equation here, you get that this is minus p0 prime. Okay. But minus p0 prime is precisely given here, and it's given here. So this is h p square. And let me put back this h, which is a dot over a dot over a p square. Okay. So this is that equation here. Which is miraculous. So you have pp dot on the left-hand side, and then you have a dot over a and p square. So you can cancel on p. And then you are getting that from here is that dp over p is minus dA over a. or that P is proportional to 1 over A. So the magnitude of the spatial momentum is proportional to 1 over scale factor in your FRW spacetime. So now this simple equation actually has amazing consequences. And again, there's lots of physics coming from this very, very simple calculation. So far, if you look through our derivation, in some sense, everything is true also for massless particles. You can everywhere put m equal to 0, apart from the definition of that lambda parameter. So that's a little bit more complicated in the null case. But yeah, once I can write it in terms of lambda in the m equal to 0 case as well. It's just the relation between the proper time and lambda is not given by that equation. So everything is valid for both massless and massive particles. In other words, it's true for the motion of galaxies in the universe, but it's also true for the motion of light in our universe. Okay, so let me first discuss the motion of galaxies. So motion of galaxies, or particles, or if you want. So m is not equal to 0. So then the spatial momentum, the magnitude of the spatial momentum, is just the mass of that thing times v peculiar magnitude. So it's just a squared gij pi pij pi pj divided by m or whatever. Okay, so this is true. So in other words, you are kidding.
So why is it just peculiar?
Oh, no, so the definition of p is that a squared gij pi pj. Okay?
Okay.
I was a little bit lazy. I did the peculiar velocity only for k equal to 0 case.
Okay.
But you can do it for the general gij. And so that is precisely what you would call peculiar velocity, the magnitude of that. Okay, in the case of k is not equal to 0.
So it's this spatial momentum here.
So the spatial momentum is basically this spatial velocity with respect to the comoving observer and its magnitude of that. Okay, so we have, so m is of course constant. So you find that v peculiar just goes as 1 over a. Well, this is called Hubble drag. And what it tells you is that maybe you created the universe at the beginning, you know, that all the galaxies were moving like crazy with respect to each other. But as the time progresses, and as the universe is getting bigger and bigger, of course, this guy is getting smaller and smaller. So this peculiar velocity, this random motion of galaxies, is getting smaller and smaller. So if you wait long enough time, basically everything will be comoving with the universe. And these peculiar velocities, with respect to the comoving observers, will be really, really tiny.
Was any kind of work applied?
Huh?
What's any kind of work?
Oh, it's just geodesics, right? So there's no work. No work. So galaxies left on their own, meaning, of course, there is no some, you know, gravitational force. Well, gravitation is still geodesic, but local gravitational force, their own converge on Hubble flow. Meaning their random velocities actually, you know, go to, well, they are not really important. So at present, random objects in the universe, objects, have velocities which are teeny tiny, Well, not really, but it's something like 200 kilometers per second. Okay, so this is the typical motion of objects with respect to these co-moving observers at this point. Of course, if we wait long enough, this will be much smaller later on. Okay, everything just co-moving with the universe. Okay. By the way, of course, we say the universe is expanding because the physical, so even the objects, the co-moving objects, which are sitting at xi equal to constant, they actually, if you take the physical distance, which is a times xi, and a is getting bigger, so that means, this is precisely what you mean, that the physical distance is increasing in between the co-moving object. And that's why you call the universe is expanding. And as the universe is expanding, you know, the peculiar velocity is actually going down. Okay? So in fact, on the Earth, we are moving with respect to these co-moving observers. So if you actually observe the cosmic microwave background, you don't see it isotropic because of your random velocity, which is something like this 200 kilometers per second. So you have to subtract that effect, and then you will see isotropic universe. Okay. So I have 3 minutes. So now massless particles, so motion of light. So for light, you know that the spatial magnitude, the magnitude of the spatial momentum is equal to the zero component of the momentum, which of course, if you want, is related to your frequency, omega. And so looking at that, you see that omega is proportional to 1 over a. So as the universe expands, actually, the light which is coming to you is getting more and more redshifted. So this is called cosmological redshift. So, you know, the light emitted from some galaxy in early times, when it reaches you, actually is now redshifted because the universe is expanding. You can also write it as the lambda is proportional to A. So now you can introduce the redshift parameter, Z, so redshift parameter, Z, which will be the observed wavelength minus the emitted wavelength divided by the emitted one. And so if you know that lambda is proportional to A, so this will be A observed minus, well, A emitted minus 1, where P0 is observed on Earth, and T1 is when it was emitted, galaxy. So T1 is the time when the light was emitted in the galaxy in early times, and T0 when this is actually observed on the Earth. Okay, and so you have this redshift parameter, and it depends precisely on just the ratio of the scale parameters, AT0 over AT1. Okay, and this is an exact formula. Okay. And it's an exact formula and it has to do with the cosmological redshift. Okay. So now, how is this related to this famous observation of Hubble?
Don't you have a contribution to the redshift due to this peculiar?
Sorry?
Don't we have a contribution to the
redshift? Sure, sure. Yeah, yeah. I'm just subtracting that at this point. Yeah, yeah. Of course, if you have random motions, yeah. So you have something which is, you know, going away from you with some velocity, you have the Doppler shift and stuff like that. Yeah. So there is other effects, of course. This is like only the redshift due to the expansion. Okay. So now, just 2 more minutes. Let me arrive at famous Hubble's law. which is how basically the cosmology started. So connection is Hubble's law. So for nearby objects, you can say you can expand, so forth, for nearby galaxies, you can expand A of T1 to be A of T0, and then you just do the Taylor expansion. So it's 1 plus T1 minus T0, and then A dot over A, which is H of T0, and plus other terms, just keeping the first non-trivial term. So then if you do this expansion and plug it for your formula for redshift parameter, so then you find that Z, which is AT0 over AT1 minus 1, right? AT0 AT1 minus 1. And so if you do that, you just find that it's T0 minus T1 and A0. Okay, so the redshift parameter is proportional to is some constant here, A0, and then this thing here. But if you recover C, which of course I'm setting everywhere C equal to 1, then this is just a physical distance, D. A physical distance. So in other words, for nearby objects, for nearby galaxies, you have Z is equal to A0 times D, something like that. So now Hubble came, Hubble observed the galaxies, and he noticed that actually their spectrum is redshifted, and this redshift is actually bigger for further galaxies. And so he said, well, maybe these galaxies are, the light of these galaxies is redshifted because these galaxies are going away from me. And so he interpreted, so Hubble interpreted this, there, that's it, as Doppler shift. So he said, this set, the change, you know, the redshift of the light is due to Doppler shift, and this is just V over C in the non-relativistic case. So then we are getting that V, there is some constant, so this be proportionally. Anyway, so we are getting that the velocity of the galaxies, how quickly they are going away from us, is given by H0 times their distance. Okay? So the further the galaxy is, he concluded they must be going faster and faster away from us. It seems like they all started in one origin, and then you know they started going away from us, and so further away they are, they have to move faster from us. Okay? And then this constant of proportionality is typically parametrized by 100, and then the uncertainty in that is small h, and that's in kilometers per second per megaparsec. So if you have a galaxy which is 1 megaparsec far away, it's approximately moving away from you 100 kilometers per second. And this h, the recent observations are like something like 0.67 plus minus 0.01. Okay, so 67 kilometers away. Okay, so let me stop here. But just remember that all this thing here is just for nearby object. Whereas this is an exact formula for the redshift parameter. So you have exact expression here for, and so you justify that by just saying, well, in GR, the scale factor is changing. So Hubble thought, well, this is just a Doppler shift, but the interpretation of the Doppler shift just relies on this expansion in some sense. It's valid only for nearby objects. It's very difficult to say what's happening is the Doppler shift for object which are further away because your geometry is not flat. Okay, so let me stop here.